From the land to Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the second day of July 2025. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson. We'll hear from Gary Schnitke, agricultural economist, about the One Big Beautiful Bill. It also includes a farm bill and is being voted on now in Washington, D.C. And then we'll turn our attention to the weather forecast with Drew Lerner on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
September corn for the day settled $4.18, up 12. December at 4.33.5, 11.5 cents higher, and the March at 4.48.75, up 10.75. September beans up 21.25 at 10.39.75. November at $10.48, up 20.75. Bean meal 3.10 higher. The bean oil up $1.36, and soft red winter wheat gained 15 cents to settle at 5.64 for the September. The July hard red winter wheat at 5.22.75, up 12 cents for the day. And the live cattle futures in Chicago finished $1.70 higher on the afternoon. Greg Johnson from TGM, that's TotalGrainMarketing.com, now joins us to take a look at what's been happening in the marketplace. Hello, Greg. Thank you for being with us. Where would you like to start with the markets today?
Well, I think we've got a little bit of a bounce today, finally, off of contract lows in the corn. But we saw the weekly crop ratings improve in most states except for Illinois. Illinois had a big drop in the soybean ratings. Last week, Illinois was 61% good to excellent, which is rather low. Usually we're in the 70s this time of year, but 61, we went down to 54. Percent good to excellent. All the other states basically were unchanged. The U.S. average was unchanged at 66 percent good to excellent. Last year we were 67 on the beans. But Illinois, according to the weekly crop progress report, we are one of the worst states in the Midwest when it comes to soybean conditions. I'm not exactly sure. Here in central Illinois, I think our beans look pretty darn good. But obviously the wet weather in southern Illinois and maybe the dry weather in northern Illinois maybe is making their beans look a little bit worse than what ours do around here. On the corn side, we dropped 3 points from 74% to 71%. Anything in the 70s is still good, though, so I don't think that's going to affect the market. And the actual national crop went from 70% to 73%, last year 67%. So according to the numbers, the corn crop is in good shape, and I think that probably accounts for the contract lows that we saw. But the soybean number is a little surprising, especially in Illinois.
Usually at this point, we look forward not into the July WASD very much, unless we think there's going to be some acreage changes. And there really won't be, based on what we saw in the acreage report from USDA. We look forward to the August crop production report. However, we have the 90-day, we're done with the trade thing coming up very shortly.
Well, or are we?
Yeah, that
depending
too.
Depending on who you listen to. Trump says that it will not be extended, but one of his underlings said that it very well could be extended, that there's almost no way that we'll have an agreement done before. These things just take that long. So, I know Trump is trying to put pressure on the other countries to, come to a resolution, but it would not surprise me a bit if the July 9th deadline gets extended.
We'll set that aside. Maybe it will not have that big of an impact and will be status quo going into that crop production report by the time we get to the August. Now, farmers, I know, have been asking you, Greg, I'm at contract lows. Is there going to be a time before I have to run this across the scale, whether it's corn or soybeans, that I might have an opportunity to make a sale?
Yeah, and it's going to have to be weather related. We've had very good exports. The demand continues to result in a lower carryout month to month. We're down to 1.35, but the trade just doesn't seem to care. With a big Brazilian crop coming on, they think that will buffer. Be enough to serve as a buffer between the tight U.S. old crop stocks and then the plentiful potential new crop coming online. So it's probably not going to be continued good export demand, even though that's probably what we'll see. We'll probably see the export number increase one more time in the July report. But the market just doesn't seem to worry whether that number is 1.35 or 1.25 even. It just, you know, yes, it's tight, but in another 3 months, 3.5 months, it won't be tight if we have normal weather in July and August. So it's probably going to have to take some weather problems. We haven't got to pollination yet, but if we don't have pollination problems, if we get normal rainfall in July and August, the 185 or the 181 corn yield that the USDA is using, if you use the good to excellent ratings as a proxy for a yield, you could make an argument that we might have a 185 national yield out there, in which case, you know, the carryout would go from 1.75 to maybe over 2 billion to 2.1 billion. So that's the potential downside. If we have another 2 billion bushel carryover, we could see December corn drop below $4, not tremendously below four, but 390. I think 390 to 490 was the range we talked about prior to planting. You know, if we had problems, we could be up close to $5, but if we didn't, we could be a little bit below $4. And without problems, we're at 425 today. December corn, and by proxy, the old crop corn could drop another 25 cents going into harvest if everything goes well in July and August. Now, you know, that's a big if, but I just want to remind farmers that this crop yield at 181 could go up. It could go down, but it could be increased as early as the August. I don't think the USDA will raise the yield in the July report, but they certainly could in the August report.
Well, 350 cash corn, aren't you just fun today? One last thing, hedge pressure coming out of that Safrina corn crop. How, when does it come into the marketplace? Because there is a delay, a bit of a delay. Unlike here where the corn crops are across the scale and it gets hedged and it feels like it happens really fast, there it takes some time, I think, for it to actually make its way to the port, and that's where the hedge pressure comes in.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Right now they're in the process of exporting beans. Most of the ports are concentrated on getting beans exported, so that corn probably won't get exported for another month or two, and that could, you know, with the big as big a crop as what they're talking, that could obviously spill over into our traditional harvest export season. So it could have an impact on our September-October exports very easily, just because of the big soybean crop and the big corn crop down there. You just can't get it all moved at once, and it's going to take time.
Hey, thank you much. We'll talk with you again next week.
All right. Thanks, Todd.
That is Greg Johnson. He is with TGM, TotalGrainMarketing.com. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Gary Schnittke, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the U of M, to discuss the reconciliation bill, or the big, beautiful bill, that contains, essentially, Gary, as you related to me, a farm bill inside of it that's not getting a lot of attention. You, Nick Paulson, Jonathan Kappas, and Carl Zuloff have written an article about a particular portion of this. It's related to base acres for the Farm Doc Daily website. Can you tell me a little bit about the inclusion of a farm bill in the reconciliation bill? How unusual is this?
The inclusion of the farm bill is a relatively unusual thing. It's been a while. It might have happened in the last time in the Bush administration, and I'm not even sure that was a reconciliation bill. What makes this unusual is that bill includes changes to the Commodity Title Program, PLC, and ARC. It includes changes to crop insurance. It increases basic and optional units of premium subsidies, and it also strengthens SCO, makes it such that every Illinois farmer will have to consider SCO. And it also includes a provision for adding base acres. So and that's what our article was about this time. But this is part of that reconciliation bill. It's in both the House and the Senate versions, so both of which have passed. And now they're moving to a reconciliation between the two, and we'll see where that process goes. But if these bills do pass, we will likely have a farm bill as part of that.
The SCO subsidy would benefit farmers in Illinois, but also across the Corn Belt, correct?
Currently, SCO it stops at 86% down to the coverage level of RP. The bill will increase that coverage level from 86% to 90%, and it will also increase the premium subsidy or premium support on it from 65% to 80%. So essentially, farmers will be paying 20% of the expected payments if it's rated properly, and we would argue that in the Midwest it probably is not. It's still 80% subsidy makes it a gainer in most years.
Yeah, and by rated properly in the Midwest, you mean it's underrated in the Midwest, and right.
You pay too much in premium for the payouts that you get from it. And there's a couple of reasons for that. That's a long-standing problem with the Midwest crops, as well as the mechanism that RMA uses to calculate expected yields has lagged yields in the Midwest. We've had exceptional yields, and their expected yields have been below our actual yields in 8 out of 10 years in most cases, and there's some counties where it's been below it 10 out of 10 years. So,
All right, now let's turn your attention to the article that you and your co-authors have penned. This one is about base acres. There are some things in the reconciliation bill that you find interesting and want to talk about as it's related to these base acres and how they could be updated if this bill passes.
the bill includes a provision that would allow for each FSA farm, farmers or landowners could add base acres to that farm. And the existing base acres on that farm would stay the same, but if three types of acres are above the base acres in the sum of those, you can would add base acres. For Midwest and Illinois, situations, if the most likely one would be plantings from 2019 through 2023, the average of those plantings of corn, soybeans, and other program crops exceeds base acres. If they do, then that farm could add those base acres to that farm. That would benefit many producers in the Midwest. But the bigger benefits come from the two other types that are added to it. The other two types are number one, up to 15% of tillable acres of non-program crops could be added, and that there would be an eligibility requirement that would be specified by Farm Service Agency. But if you have crops in anything but pasture and grasses, it would likely be added to that. Most farms in the Midwest plant program crops, corn and soybeans, so they wouldn't benefit from that. And there's also a category called unassigned acres, which are old upland cotton acres that have never gotten back into the program, and those could be added through this process as well. And that will skew those acres outside the Midwest to other areas.
What does it mean across the board going forward for the farm economy, in your opinion?
This bill adds up to 30 million base acres, and that's an 11% increase. That 11% increase will, again, increase the cost of commodity titles by about the same amount, maybe a little bit more, depending on where those base acres get added, but it'll increase the commodity title by 11%. For Midwest farmers, it will help those that have been planting more corn and soybeans than their base acres. They will get to add acres. It doesn't do anything to rectify the situation where you're underplanting. So anybody that's been underplanting again, that happens mainly outside the Midwest, will be able to maintain those acres. It doesn't cause a fundamental matching of base acres to planted acres, but it does help those that are overplanting their base.
Why would you want to match base acres to
two planted acres in this situation?
The primary reason is that ARC and PLC, or the commodity title programs, should be countercyclical payments and offering countercyclical help. Therefore, the closer they match actual plantings, the better off that matching will occur.
And so this then would push producers to do what because of the policies?
So it's not going to producers in the Midwest to do anything, really. I mean, you will choose to add base acres and keep going. Where the issues actually come in is rice, peanuts, and cotton, which have many more acres above their planted acres, so they're getting more program payments than they're planting.
Wait, why is that the case? Why do they have more acres in the programs than they actually plant? What's happening? Are they double counting in some way?
No. So over time, rice, peanuts, and cotton have decreased in acres, and the base acres were set historically. So we have this historic basis, and plantings now are below that. The other thing that happened was that most of the time when we've added acres in the past, landowners were given a chance, and they could often keep their current base acres or update them to new base acres. And they would choose the alternative that would maximize their payments, which was generally to keep as much cotton, rice, and peanut acres as you could. That also happened in the Midwest. When we were given choice between corn acres and bean acres, we always chose the corn acres because corn acres tended to pay more. So if you're looking at base acres relative to planted acres, there's several crops that have many more base acres than planted acres, and that would include wheat, cotton, rice, and peanuts. And there's some crops with more planted acres than base acres, and the big one there is soybeans.
And what does that cause? I mean, let's just stay in the South because I think this is easier to understand, but I'm not certain that's the case. So if you're a farmer in the South and you have either had historical cotton or peanut base acres, let's go into the Southeast, and now you don't plant as many of those, but you have replaced them with soybean, for instance, what does that mean?
It means that you're getting the cotton, rice, and peanut payment rather than the soybean payment. Here is the difference in projected payments on a national basis if these bills pass. Corn would have a $31 average payment per base acre. Soybeans, $21, so less than corn. But seed cotton would have $91. Peanuts would have $256 per base acre. And rice, $268 per base acre. So those three crops have more than at least triple sometimes 5 to 6 times more payments per base acre than corn and soybeans.
Does that kind of disparity happen across much of the acreage outside of the Corn Belt? Meaning is that acreage, and it would shift how much that acreage is worth by a long shot, right? And so I'm assuming the South is really overpriced per acre, based on this.
The South would have more seed, cotton, peanut, and rice payments, and that would be the big area. The Western states probably have more wheat acres than are being planted right now, but that's a relatively small payment compared to what's happening in the cotton, peanut, and rice area.
Yeah, and so it wouldn't have nearly as dramatic an impact.
The point of this is if you look at the projected payments, they're 3 times as much for seed cotton, 8 times as much for peanuts and rice than corn or soybeans. And those are the sorts of subsidy differences that are going on those base acres when they're not being planted.
Unwinding that is always very tricky, especially in rural areas, because so much of the tax base is agriculture or farm land, and it has an impact on hospitals and rural fire protection, and more importantly, school districts.
Unwinding those is really hard, but we're making that unwinding harder by making those disparities wider. And I would argue that there's no reason why southern rural communities are worse off than Midwest rural communities. And so why are we providing more subsidies there than here? I mean, we've all seen what's happened to many Midwestern communities, particularly those that are away from some of the population centers.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Todd.
Gary Schnicki is a member of the FarmDoc team, an agricultural economist here at the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. You may read more from him on our website. Look for reconciliation bill proposals to add base acres at willag.org. Drew Lerner from World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City now joins us to take a look at what's been happening in the growing regions across the planet. Let's start in North America. The Corn Belt, just all good, Drew? Just all good, right?
It's just all good. You know, it's absolutely amazing. You know, the rains just keep coming off and on. We're getting perfect temperatures, and you couldn't ask for a better deal. My biggest fear is, you know, how big is this crop going to end up getting, right? We did have some trouble earlier in the year, so it's not going to be perfect. But yeah, the weather looks really good, and it's going to stay that way at least 10 days and probably for a couple of weeks yet.
The Canadian prairie still having a little trouble?
Yeah, you know, they did have that one decent rain about 10 days ago. And since then, it's been, they're kind of limping along still. They still have a lot of dryness in the subsoil, especially in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. And it doesn't look like they're going to get good solid rains. They get a little bit of this off and on shower type pattern that we're seeing here in the States. But up there, they really need a more solid, significant, widespread rain event. And I don't have that on the charts right now. So we do need to kind of keep an eye on it. And if for some weird reason we do get a stronger ridge of high pressure to build up at some point in the latter half of July or early August, that could be a real issue for Canada if they don't fix this moisture deficit between now and then. My gut feeling is they'll probably get along okay. It's not going to be the best year they've had, that's for sure. But they may still be able to eke out their crops as long as they keep these showers once in a while occurring.
The growing regions of Western Europe, particularly wheat in France, still hot and dry?
Yeah, what a mess. You know, some of the latest production numbers coming out of Europe haven't been as dramatically bad as for the winter crops as what was feared for some spots. But, you know, France is definitely high on the list. They are taking it on the chin. They've been driest, below normal precipitation for much of the country since January. And the heat that has come on here in the last few weeks has really pushed them over the edge. Now, for some of that winter crop, you know, most of the winter crops are done, but some of the spring cereals and some of the sunseed and corn and soybeans and whatever else you can think of that's produced in France and parts of the UK, even Germany to some degree, is really being stressed at the moment. Now, there's a breakdown in the ridge occurring right now. Temperatures have been in the 90s to lower 100s every day this week so far in parts of France and Germany, the Low Countries, such as Belgium and Netherlands, and even parts of England. But it is coming to an end. We're pushing the ridge out of the way, and we're going to go through about a week, maybe a little bit more than that, of opportunity for scattered showers. Now, I don't see a lot of good rain in France during much of this period. They will have some showers, absolutely, and their temperatures will come down maybe 20 degrees. So there's going to be some relief there. But when that ridge comes back the second time, which is going to be in that second weekend, we are probably going to see some pretty serious impact if there's no more rain than what I see in the pipeline right now. So a pretty serious situation for them. And it's also really dry in southeastern Europe in the lower Danube River basin, which is runs through Romania and Bulgaria and some neighboring areas of Serbia. So all of that region down there is really getting dry and hot too.
Yeah, corn production there. And then if you go north and to the east, you do Poland, Ukraine and Russia. What do we see across the Black Sea area there?
Yeah, most of those areas are still doing relatively well. There hasn't been nearly as much heat there. If you can think back to the early part of the spring, there was a lot of trouble with cold, though. They got off to a really poor, slow start and a lot of freeze damage. I can't remember just exactly how many fruits and vegetables were wiped out in the spring because of all the cold air in Eastern Europe and parts of the Western former Soviet Union. So those areas had a tough start, but since then it's been fairly good. And now we are seeing an opportunity for abundant rain to occur across central and northern parts of Russia. And that's probably going to be the next issue for that part of the world. This would be north of Ukraine, north of Russia's southern region, and from northern Kazakhstan northward. So that whole crop region from one end of Russia's production area to the other, there will be probably 1 to 3 and local 4-inch rains that will occur over the next 10 days. And that may not seem like all that much, but it rains a little bit every day, and the ground is already adequate to surplus on moisture. So they don't have much room for that moisture, and there is the potential we're going to end up with some wet weather disease for the spring crops and perhaps some delay in the wheat harvest, for the winter wheat harvest, that is, and maybe a few other winter crops as well.
And finally, has enough rain fallen in the driest parts of China that they have recovered from drought?
Yeah, you know, we just took a look at China's drought monitor earlier this morning, and earlier this season, we had widespread drought in that Yellow River Basin area and parts of the North China Plain. Well, that's been whittled down to just a couple of really minor little pockets of dryness here and there. And for all practical purposes, they're back to a relatively normal moisture profile. And there is more rain in the pipeline. Now, there is another area of dryness developing in China now in the southeast. This would be more of a rice and sugarcane production area. So we're not going to make a big issue out of it for right now, but we'll keep an eye on it as we go forward in time. And somebody may come up and tell you that Xinjiang, I'm probably not pronouncing that right, but Xinjiang is the northwesternmost province in China. It is in the middle of a drought, apparently. And what I want to tell you is that don't pay it any attention, because they irrigate all the crops in that particular province and the water supply should be sufficient. But it has been really dry. I don't think there's been a drop of rain in some of that cotton and corn production area in months. So there is a really dry issue there, but they're not excessively hot and there is sufficient irrigation water available.
Hey, thanks much, Drew. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online, listen to us on demand at willag.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.